I was told that I would start after 8. So you guys got me for more than an hour. Let's see if I can last more than an hour. Sean Alcoholic. I am arriving. Oh gosh, I do not like being seen. I do not like being seen in front of all y'all. I do not want to tell my story in front of all y'all. For me, it really comes down to this belief that I have nothing to offer, that I am no good, that you guys are gonna see me and hate me, that you're only gonna see me as the little Asian guy. I come here full of fear to be seen by you guys. And when I'm in fear, I do things like I want to drink. You know, I want to seek escape. I want to seek oblivion. I want to run away. I want to hide. I want to stay home and just chill on my couch and with the blanket and just watch TV. And I stand here because I believe in the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous that it has given me. I stand here today because I believe that God has my back. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not have those things at all. It's a miracle to me that I'm standing here in front of you guys, willing to tell my story, you know? And it really is a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous and the gift of sobriety. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I came here August 28th of 2006. It's gonna be 20 years next week. Nice. And I don't say that to pat myself on the back, but it's just so fucking shocking to me. I cannot believe that I'm standing here 20 years later at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on a Saturday night when I should be at that time what I was thinking, like going out, partying, having fun, you know? Today I can say this is such a privilege. This is such a gift to be asked to speak in front of you guys. And that's how much Alcoholics Anonymous has changed me, you know? A really selfish young man, you know, who all he cared about was just to feel good and just to run away from his feelings, you know, to willing to bear myself in front of you all. That's how I'm arriving. I'm gonna share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. What it was like, you know. So I grew up in Palos Verdes, which is upper class like suburb in Los Angeles, and my parents were Korean immigrants. They immigrated here. My mom immigrated here when she was 14. My dad immigrated here when he was 22, They had me at 25, and they wanted to make the best life for me, you know? And they looked at all the different school systems in LA County, and they chose Palos Verdes. So they, you know, did their best to move there so they can send me to a good school. And, I think I was born a relatively free and joyous kid, but then my mom had different ideas. And she wanted me to be a piano maestro. And so she would wake me up at 5 in the morning every morning and practice 2 hours of piano before going to class, you know, going to school. And, you know, she signed me up for swimming lessons and, you know, all these other extracurricular activities. And there was just no room for play. There was just no room for friends. I grew up a very, very lonely kid. The other thing that, she was very volatile and crazy. I mean, she's a sweet lady, but she was a crazy lady. And, she would tell, the way I describe my mom is her first love is money. And every day she would tell me how much she spent on me. And every day she would tell me, you know, things like I spent this much money on piano, and you still suck, you know. like why am I spending all this money on you, you know? And but she, you know, she, that's just the way she showed love, you know. And she just wanted a better life for me. But one of the things that happened for me, growing up, was I just became very isolated, very alone, and I just remember just feeling like I was in prison and like my world was gray, you know? And then, so growing up like that, I finally made it to high school. One of the things that I found in high school was drugs and alcohol. And when the way I describe finding drugs and alcohol in high school, like my life turned from black and white and gray to color. Like, all of a sudden, I can feel happiness. All of a sudden, I can feel freedom. All of a sudden, I can feel joy. And there was a tool, there was something that I can ingest and take to immediately change that. Change my reality, change the way I feel, change the way I view myself. And so the first time I drank alcohol, I lived on a hill, and I put my car in neutral. I stuck out of the house and parked up, put my car in neutral and rolled down the hill. And then I went to a Ralph's shopping supermarket, and then picked up my friends and stole a handle of vodka. And then we went to Redondo Beach and sat on the lifeguard tower. And then we cracked it open, and then I offered it to my friends, and none of my friends wanted to drink. And so I just downed the whole thing. And and I, the last thing I remember, which was like 5 or 10 minutes later, was like peeing on the wall at the beach. And then the next morning, I just woke up with bruises all over my body because my mom was trying to beat me awake because it was a Friday morning at that point. And I was just so sick. But that's basically how I drank. From then on, it was just oblivion. I just wanted to get out of myself so badly, you know? And so I wasn't a chill drinker. The purpose of me to drink was to get fucked up, you know? And so that's just how I drank. And I did it as much as I could and as often as I could. And so I got a fake ID in high school. I was not going to class. And just going to my friend, for some reason, his parents had a house on the hill that was sitting empty because they bought another house down the hill. And they were gonna sell it, but they were in the middle of a divorce. So we just like hung out at that house all the time. And we would just pick up beer and then just drink at the house every day. And that's what I did, you know? I loved it. I thought I really met the true me, you know? Like, this was who I am. This is who I'm gonna be for the rest of my life. And drugs was a part of my story. And it was just really an accelerant. And I found lower companions through drugs. And, you know, everyone who graduated from my high school, you know, they all went to university, but then I found my purpose was to party. You know, I wasn't gonna go to university. I didn't really care. And so, you know, through my drug, friends that were, I was doing drugs with, like, I would just go out. I would work during the day, go to community college, go to work during the day, and then meet up with them at the bars at night and just have fun. And I was pretty much a daily drunk driver at that point. And finally, when I was 19 years old, on March 11th of 2006, I got blackout drunk once again at a bar in Torrance. And then in the blackout, I ran out of cigarettes, I guess. And I went to go get cigarettes. And I I got in my mom's Yukon and drove and made a left turn going eastbound on a westbound street. And in my mom's Yukon, I hit someone head on, and he was driving a Ford Taurus, and he was 21 years old. And I came out without a scratch. I'm like browning out. I remember talking to the cop. I remember being in the cop car. I remember like ditching my drugs. You know, that young man, you know, he unfortunately was hospitalized for a month and a half. And I woke up in jail the next day, and I was pinching myself, thinking that I woke up in a bad dream. This was not my life. This is not how it's supposed to be. And I couldn't pitch myself awake out of that reality. And, you know, my parents, you know, as much as I hated them, and as much as, like, you know, they were really strict on me and stuff like that, like, they were, of course, the ones I called. You know, they were very big enablers in my life. And so I called my parents, and they bailed me out. And I just remember my dad picking me up from jail and walking down that long hallway, and him taking me to lunch. And I just went to the bathroom in that restaurant and just cried my eyes out, you know? It's taking me back. You know, up until that point, I just wanted to feel happy and free. You know, I thought I was just having a good time. I didn't realize that was the first real big slap in the face for me, that my actions have consequences. And up until that point, you know, I was a depressed kid. You know, I was self-medicating. And to put, like, you know, potentially killing another young man on top of that, I really went to a dark place. You know, I really believed at that point that all I did, like, I was born on this earth just to hurt people. That was my worth, and there's no worth in the human life there's no worth in my life if that's all I was doing. And so, but my parents sweep me up, and they got me a lawyer, and an expensive lawyer. And he, I was looking at 3 felonies and a civil lawsuit. I was looking at 10 years in jail. And one of the things that my lawyer told me was he gave me a piece of paper, like, to get a court card signed. And he's like, you know, like, you have to start going to meetings. And that's my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. You know, growing up Korean American, you know, like, from an immigrant family, there's just no such thing as psychiatrists or psychologists or like group therapy or like Alcoholics Anonymous. There just wasn't any of that. Like, you know, like, you just presented yourself well with the nice cars that we can barely afford to church, and put on a good face, and then, you know, like, talk all the shit back at home and just judge everyone, right? And so that was the culture, right? And so this idea of, like, going to a group of, like, a room like this and talk about feelings and our problems and my family and my issues was just so foreign. And so, anyways, I took this court card, and I went to my first meeting in Torrance, and at Torrance Memorial Hospital. Oh, gosh. And I heard, I came in a room like this, and it was like 50 people in there or something. And they were all, you know, this is just my experience, but they were all middle-aged white people. Right? And in walks in this 19-year-old kid, and I'm like, what the fuck am I doing here? And you know, they were talking about losing houses. They were talking about divorces, losing children, driving a car into a pool. You know, like, these were not things that I had, nor have I lost, you know? So I was just like, oh, yeah, this is not it. Oh, and then on top of that, like, they did the Lord's Prayer. you know, at the end. And I bristled, you know, at the Lord's Prayer, because at that point I did not believe in God, you know. But I needed to get this court card signed. And so I kept going to meetings, but I kept on drinking and using to, try to shove the pain away, drink the pain away. But it wasn't working anymore, you know, because of this belief that all my worth was just hurting people. And so I kept on going to meetings. I finally went to this meeting called St. Francis, up on the hill, Hope on the Hill. And there was this guy, I was the type of person that would go late, leave early, not talk to anybody, not want to be seen. Oh, I went to meetings on coke. I don't recommend that. You know, it was not good. And then I went to this meeting, Hope on the Hill, and there's this one guy who just pulled me aside as I was waiting for my ride outside the meeting. And he started asking me, he introduced himself, Mike Phillips. And he's like, how are you sleeping? How you, like, are you eating okay? How you feeling? I was like, why is he asking me these questions? And then he hands me a slip of paper with his phone number. He's like, call me. And I took that piece of paper, said thank you, and my friend came and picked me up, and we went to go drink. And then the next day, I called him. That was a Sunday morning, I think. And then he's like, hey, I'm going to pick you up, and I'm going to take you to my meetings. I was like, okay, fine, whatever. And he picked me up and took me to this meeting called Bellflower Big Book Group. And I remember driving up to that like little building, and there's just like people like crawling with people, just people everywhere. And there's this like 40, 50 person deep greeting line. Everyone's so happy. And I was just so nervous. And I remember Judy Aramaki, you know, this little Japanese girl, like this little Japanese, you know, she had like 30 years of sobriety at that time. And she just like saw me from across the building or across the room, and she just ran up to me and just gave me the biggest hug. She was so excited to see me. And she was the first Asian that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was the first gay Asian that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. The other thing that I heard, it's a 2 10-minute speaker and a 45-minute speaker. One of the 10-minute speakers got up, Joe H. I remember it clear as day, and he talked about his sexuality. And I was like, oh my God, there's queer people in these rooms. Like, what the hell? And they're talking about it openly. Like, what the hell? And I just remember leaving that room and just feeling like, okay, maybe there is something here. Maybe there's something, like, if these people can do it, then maybe I can do it. So I just gave it a shot. And so I'm so grateful for that meeting, because they really loved me and they really took care of me. They picked me, you know, there were a couple guys in that meeting that drove 45 minutes out of the way, one way to pick me up and 45 minutes back to take me home, to take me to that meeting. And there was a series of meetings that we would go to Monday, Wednesday, and then Friday. And then the guys that I got sober with, they started or Ben Lucero, he started a Sunday meeting. So I started going to a Sunday meeting. But, you know, there's so much I can say about that, about Alcoholics Anonymous and that meeting. But, you know, I didn't identify, I really, you know, came into Alcoholics Anonymous looking at the outsides and thinking that I did not belong. And then I started hearing the feelings, the people talk about their feelings and what they've been through. And that's when I started identifying, like, maybe this can work for me. You know, all I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was to get the cord off my back. All I wanted was the heat off my back, you know, like, and what I got was so much more, you know. And so, you know, at that meeting, there's this guy, Ben Lucero, and he was just an angel of a man. And he just walked the talk, right? He just showed me how to live a sober man. And he took me under his wing, and I called him every day. And before then, I never knew how to be honest. And I didn't know I was dishonest, you know? I didn't know what honesty was. But he was the first person that I ever told, like, you know, my true, like, who I truly was. Basically, you know, like, you guys all showed me how to live and be a man, you know? And so you guys taught me about, you know, getting commitments. And so I got commitments at meetings. You guys told me to get a sponsor and do the steps. Mike P ended up being my sponsor, and we went through the steps together. And then you guys told me to go to meetings no matter what. And so that's what I did. And one of the things that ended up happening was, even though the problems were the same, I was still going to court. I was still looking at years behind bars. My perception of my life started changing, right? No longer was it just poor me with these felonies. It was, I started feeling, you know, happy. I started feeling a part of. I started feeling connection. I started feeling love that I've never thought I was capable of experiencing. I remember distinctly, like, you know, Ben talking to me on the phone, and then he, you know, just shared with me something about his life, something private, well, I mean, he's passed, but maybe I should talk about this. But I mean, I divulged something very private to him, what I thought was very dramatic, and then I remember getting off the phone and I just started crying, because, like, I've never felt empathy and love for another person like that way until that phone call, you know. And I remember, like, you know, before I got sober, my dad, my dad's an orphan, and so his uncle was his parent, and his uncle was dying of cancer, and we were all in the hospital room, the whole family, and we just filled up this room, and everyone in that room was crying except for me, you know, because I was, like, so fucked up, you know, like, I just could not feel a thing, you know, and I was like, I truly thought something was wrong with me. And so that moment that I had with Ben, like, it really shifted the way, like, I felt about myself. So I had experiences like that. I had experiences where I can laugh with you guys. You know, I heard stories of people changing their lives from being a liar, cheat, and a thief to being of service. You know, I heard people talk about the obsession of drugs and alcohol and having that obsession lifted and no longer having to live that in that cycle of hell anymore. And slowly but surely, you know, I started believing in what you guys were saying, you know. And I still believe the things that you guys told me back then. I still believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is a room for transformation and change, that change is possible in here. And that belief I hold so dear, because now that I'm older, I'm not 19 years old anymore, and I'm out living in the world, working among normies and stuff like that. And a lot of people don't see the world that way. A lot of people don't believe in change. A lot of people think that they're stuck, you know? And even if they don't have the disease, they think that things are stuck. And I don't live that way, you know? I have a community that believes in change and that we could talk about change, you know, changing ourselves. And also knowing that we are responsible for our own lives and for that change, right? And so, So I got sober at Bellflower Big Book, and that was August of 28th of 2006. And, you know, the court case, you know, it ended up working out. Like, you know, it helps to have a white lawyer to, like, you know, get me out of stuff. you know, and you know, I got 480 hours of volunteer service and like 2 years of probation and a bunch of like fees and I lost my license and stuff like that. But I was still going to school and I was still working and I was still going to meetings, and I got the opportunity to go to UC San Diego in 2008. So in 2008, I moved down to San Diego, and one of the things that happened, you know, when I moved down here was that, you know, San Diego doesn't do AA right. You know, like, I was just so used to the structure, you know, and I was so used to, like, you know, people saying, sit down and shut up, you know, and I was so used to only wearing collared shirts and like long pants, you know, and closed-toed shoes at meetings. And, you know, San Diego's not like that. You know, San Diego's very like, you know, laid back. And so I was trying to go to meetings here, and I was just like, oh, this is not it. And so I just stopped. I just stopped going to meetings for 6 months. But what ended up happening during those 6 months is that I started going crazy. All I did was hole up in my room and play video games. I did not go to school. You know, I did not, I didn't go to meetings. I wasn't keeping in touch with people. And I was going to lose my mind. And so, you know, at that time, I didn't have a car. So I biked my ass over to the Tuesday night meeting in La Jolla Shores. And I met a couple guys there. And I started going to meetings again. And, you know, even though, like, you know, I had all these judgments, you know, I just kept on going, you know? Like, the feet were practice. They were, you know, like, and they just moved on its own. And that's, I think, one of the things that has kept me sober for this long is the fact that I still go to meetings, you know? It's the practice of going to meetings, talking to other alcoholics, and working with a sponsor. That's, okay. You know, I see, like, it's crazy to me getting sober at 19 years old and seeing all these people come in and out. You know, I've made the best of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, but these best friends also relapse too. And the heartbreak that caused, like, that I felt losing, like, those friendships, you know, it was incredibly hard. It was incredibly hard to go to college in my 20s when there's drinking and alcohol everywhere, surrounded by people where it's totally normal to, like, you know, act a fool and try to be sober in that environment, you know? So, you know, at UCSD, there was no AA meetings. And so one of the things that Ben taught me was that if you don't have a meeting, create one. And because he showed me, like, we literally created a meeting together. And so when I went to UCSD, I found other alcoholics, and we started a meeting on campus. And that meeting is still going today. And there's now, I think, three more meetings on top of that. And in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a host, like a group of Meriwether friends, right? There was other students like me in their 20s trying to stay sober and try to go to school. But we were all batshit crazy. You know, like, and I remember being five years sober on campus and thinking that I just, like, understood everything about Alcoholics Anonymous and knew exactly how to work this program and knew exactly, like, how to live life. I don't know shit. But, you know, I'm so grateful for that meeting because, you know, like, one of the girls that went to that meeting, her name is Kat, And she just left. I just dropped her off at the San Diego airport to for her to go back to Idaho, and we're still sober together, you know. And I've, you know, again, met the best friends. You know, there's people in Alcoholics Anonymous throughout my sobriety where I can call at any moment, whatever I was experiencing, whatever shame I was feeling, whatever self-hatred I was feeling, I could just tell my truth and they would just listen, you know? And oftentimes, just the fact of just saying things out loud was the solution. It wasn't to get a word of advice. Sometimes the advice is good, sometimes the advice is bad. Usually, a lot of times the advice is good, but sometimes it's just, I get the answers just saying the truth out loud, you know? And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me too, because I never picked up the phone before that. And that was the other thing. Oh, well, anyways, so but in that room at UCSD, you know, again, like I made friends, and they decided to go back out, right? And I found it incredibly hard to want to be here, you know, want to be sober. I got incredibly resentful at the fact that I was an alcoholic. I got incredibly resentful that this was the solution, that I had to continue to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I just wanted to be normal, you know? And I hung out with normies and, like, you know, I tried that life out, you know? Thank God I didn't drink, but I was really damn close to taking a drink. You know, like, when they say, like, hang out at a barbershop, you eventually get a haircut. You know, like, I was incredibly close. And thank God I didn't get a haircut. I got sober. I stayed sober through college, you know, in my 20s. I don't know. I'm 39 now. I'm about to be, you know, 40 in, you know, at the end of the year. I just can't believe the time has passed. You know, it's just crazy to me. And you know, what is it that I want to say? When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at 19 years old, you know, I just wanted to not feel the way I was feeling, you know, and drugs and alcohol wasn't like the answer to my problems anymore at that time. And so what I found was that getting sober, I was just left with me and my own mind and my own crazy thoughts and my own feelings. But the cool thing about that is that I get to do it with you guys. I get to share whatever is going on in my heart and whatever baggage that I was feeling, you know, I get to talk about it with a trusted, a closed mouth friend, and the burden is lightened, you know? I'm kind of at a loss for words right now.
When did the monkey jump off your back?
When did the monkey jump? Oh, that's actually a really good segue. That was a really good segue, actually. You know what's funny? Like, I came, like, before this meeting, all day I was thinking about what the fuck I was going to say at this meeting. And I had a list in my mind of what I was going to talk about. And that was one of those things. And I totally forgot it at the podium. So thank you so much for that. You know, so one of the things that about me is that I have this mind that tells me that I'm a piece of shit, that tells me that I'm worthless, that tells me that I have nothing to offer. And for some reason, I spent my whole sobriety, my whole adult life, trying to get that monkey off my back. I went to therapy. I went to, transformational trainings. I did a lot of shit. And And I'm grateful for all the opportunities of healing that I got in outside of Alcoholics Anonymous too. But I remember this distinct memory of like waking up and looking at my phone, and my checking account was overdrafted again. And this was 2 years ago. And immediately, like, I had suicidal thoughts. You know, like, I guess I should back up. You know, I struggled with depression my whole life. That did not go away when I got sober. You know, when I first got sober, the valleys were really deep, and they were often. You know, as time went on, the valleys got farther and farther apart and more shallow. So they weren't as deep. But there was still this monkey on my back. And then I remember, you know, having, you know, that experience of, like, again, going into the depression again and having suicidal thoughts. And then I kept on going to meetings because I got someone called me or texted me to speak at a meeting on Wednesday night. And so I went to speak at that meeting. And at that meeting, there was a person, another alcoholic, who talked about another 12-step program about money. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, so I went up to that person after that meeting, and, you know, he told me about that program, and he told me that, like, you know, to, like, we exchanged numbers, and I started going to this other 12-step program with him that deals strictly with money, and I worked the 12 steps around money. And one of the things that came out, you know, like, it sounds obvious now, like, I don't know why it took what it took, you know? It took me, like, 17, 18 years of sobriety to get to that point. But, like, that was the first time I worked the 12 steps around money. And I, you know, there was these voices in my head, you know, the worthless voice. You know, like, you're not worth anything. Like, you lost your job. You know, like, you're worth only as much as how much money I have, you know, and I did not have a lot. And you know, working the 12 steps, I heard those voices again, and I had this experience of hearing those voices and then realizing that they were given to me. And it was my mom who told me at a very young age that I was worthless, you know, that I spent all this money on you and that, like, you're not worth shit. And I co-opted those voices and they became mine. And once I realized that those voices, you know, that was causing so much sadness within me was given to me, I immediately called my mom and I started talking to her. And I was like, hey, I want to let you know, like, I used you for a really long time to be sad. And I just want to say I'm sorry that I used you in that way and that I no longer am going to be sad anymore. And she told me, you know, it's okay, life is short. You know, like, we can't stay resentful forever. And for the longest time, you know, this voice dogged me. It caused so much confusion. And I didn't know that this voice was causing me so much pain. And all of a sudden, after that conversation, like, that voice no longer was there. I'm not saying I'm cured. I'm not saying I'm healed. But I'll say, you know, like, I still have these, like, you know, quiet voices of these little beliefs that I'm, like, worthless, you know, that I shouldn't be seen, that you guys are going to judge the shit out of me. But it's a lot easier to walk hand in hand in God when I don't believe those voices. I wouldn't have had that opportunity if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have had those opportunities if it wasn't the 12 steps. I'm forever grateful for the life that I've been given through Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps. And I'm a true, like, And that's why I say I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Again, like, this life is given to me, you know? I did not ask for this. I did not come into Alcoholics Anonymous thinking that this was gonna be my life, that I was gonna be healed of, like, these monkeys off my back, you know? I didn't come here thinking that I wanted to be of service, you know? I didn't come here thinking that I wanted a relationship with a higher power. I didn't come here to thinking that I wanted sponsees, you know? But that's what I've been given, and I'm forever grateful for the life that I've been given. And so, you know, that's why I say yes when people like John ask me to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I truly believe that I was too different to be here. You know, that, like, I would never be accepted because I was a young Asian boy. You know, but then what I have found is that I am with a true brotherhood and sisterhood, that you are me and I am you. And what I also have found is that I have found true healing within the group. You know, I did not find healing by myself. You know, it was through all of you. And so, you know, I thank you again, John, for letting me speak. I think that's all I have to share today. And if you're new, I hope you got something out of it. But thanks for having me. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Well, let's thank our speaker again, Sean L. from San Diego. All right. And I'd like to thank Sean and hope he comes back and visits us soon. Absolutely. Thanks, Sean. All right. And also, let's thank the residents of the house and the Women's Auxiliary for a fantastic dinner. You know we love that chicken fried steak. All right, and how about we let Sean close us up in the usual manner of a choice, a prayer of his choice.